Namaste. It's nice to be with you again. It's actually nice just to be sitting up again. Well, while you were practicing in here, I was practicing in my room, and I had the opportunity to explore strategies for staying present with what you would call unpleasant sensations. In fact, if you had any dreams or heard some sounds that sounded like dinosaurs calling out to each other all through the night, that was me. Every 20 minutes for about 8 hours. About 10 o'clock, I woke up in a sweat, and I realized I had a fever, and I tried to ignore that. And about 3 minutes later, I realized I had a stomach virus, and I tried to ignore that. And that didn't work. I was kind of off to the races. So I'm still feeling pretty weak, but I'm really happy to be returning. One of my intentions for this retreat was to intensify my practice, so be careful what you pray for. Tonight I wanted to talk about wise effort. There are willful practices that go into what we do, and there are also being practices, surrendered practices. When does our practice require doing? When does it require being? That's a little bit of what I'd like to explore. I'll talk about the doing practices, a little bit about the art of investigation when we are present to our experience. And then this, the art of surrender. How does that work? What is the technology of that? We'll try on a number of different practices as well. So this evening will be a pretty introverted ride. And I'm hoping that it will be of some benefit in your own practice. There's a story of a student who sat in the back of the room listening to a teacher give advice to people with their practice. And the longer the student listened, the angrier they got. And finally, she came forward and confronted the teacher and said, "You are completely inconsistent in your teachings. You tell one person that they need to focus, and you're telling the other person they should just go for a walk and sit in the sun." And the teacher said, "There is no one technique. There are only the practices that bring you back to balance and bring you back to the middle." I wanted to share with you kind of to contrast a poem and a little story that kind of illustrates some of the elements of doing. This first piece is a prayer from Clarissa Pinkola Estes. And she says, "Refuse to fall down. If you cannot refuse to fall down, refuse to stay down. If you cannot refuse to stay down, lift your heart toward heaven like a hungry beggar. Ask that it be filled, and it will be filled. You may be pushed down. You may be kept from rising. But no one can keep you from lifting your heart toward heaven. Only you. It is in the middle of misery that so much becomes clear. The one who says nothing good came of this is not yet listening." To me, this poem speaks of the rigor required to carry on through this life of suffering, to trust that in your deepest and darkest hours, no matter what occurs, you can lift your heart toward heaven. Maybe you've experienced that in your life. Maybe you've experienced it in these last couple days. The next story comes from the yoga tradition. Like many of the yoga stories, it's a little funky, but it does have some interest in it. There was once a yogi named Narad who was enlightened, whatever that means, and had the privilege of moving between heaven and earth. One day he was down on earth walking around the villages, and he saw a great many people suffering with disease, poverty, war, famine. His heart bled for the people. Narad climbed up to heaven, and there was Vishnu, sitting on a beautiful sofa, wearing silk clothes, with Lakshmi, his wife, massaging his feet, and people fanning him and feeding him grapes. He was sitting there in bliss, and he said, "Welcome, Narid. Come and sit here and tell me about your adventures." Narid said, God Vishnu, there is something wrong. All the people on earth are suffering, and you're sitting here in such opulence and joy. This cannot be right." Vishnu replied, "What do you think we should do?" And Narid said, "I should bring the people here to heaven. Everyone should be able to experience what you're experiencing." And Vishnu said, "You're right. Go get them. I will build some rooms and we'll welcome everyone here." Narid went back down to earth, and everywhere he went, he told people to meet him at a particular place and time, and he would lead them to heaven. "Tell your friends, bring your family, get everybody." And on that day, about 1 million people were there. They started to climb up the mountain toward heaven. And after a few hours of climbing, gold coins began to rain from the heavens. And everyone filled their pockets with gold. But Narid said, "Don't do that. You can't climb any higher with that weight in your pockets." The people replied, "We're not climbing any higher. Now that we have the gold, we're going back." 2/3 of the people climbed down the mountain and disappeared from sight. Narid said to the rest of the people, "Let's keep going and get to heaven." They climbed a little higher, and now it began to rain diamonds and rubies. Everybody started stuffing their pockets, and again, Narid cried, "No, don't do that. You can't climb with all that weight." And again, everybody turned to go down the mountain, except Narid and 3 other people. Narid said to the other 3, "At least we will get to heaven." And they answered, "No, Narid, we're not going to heaven." He asked, "If you're not coming with me, why didn't you pick up the gems?" They replied, "All those people who went down the mountain are going to need teachers, and they'll pay us to teach them." "They're carrying our diamonds down the hill for us." And they turned and went down the mountain to teach the people wisdom. Narid was all alone and heartbroken. He entered heaven, and there was Vishnu with a smile on his face. Narid looked at him and glared, "You knew they wouldn't come." And Vishnu said, "Narid, I've been trying for years to bring them to heaven. I don't know how to do it. I hoped you might be able to." In the yoga tradition, there's a teaching that when you do spiritual practices, they take you away from pain and bring you more happiness. But the ancient yogis actually considered happiness a problem. Heaven for them was freedom from everything, even from wealth and happiness, which they saw as obstacles to experiencing that vast expanse of consciousness that could not be disturbed by such things. That's one of the many interpretations of that story. So we get distracted by our fear, by our pain. And we also get distracted by pleasure. This life has been described as the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. And at some point in the hero's journey, we wake up to this endless cycle of suffering. And we start paying closer attention to the mechanism of entrapment and the mechanisms and the technologies that lead us to freedom. Not that long ago, if you were called to spiritual practice, you would study with whoever was nearby in your village, or at least living close by. For me, I started transcendental meditation when I was 15. I gave myself to it fully, and it fully transformed my life. I felt more creative, more present, less reactive. And I didn't know there were other meditation techniques for many, many years. These days, there are multiple practices and traditions that are freely available. There are literally secret teachings that are now available via PDF download. How do we make our way to this cornucopia of information and practices? You know, do we dig one well, or do we dig many wells? And there are different teachings around that. Those who say, dig one well, go deep. Others that say, you actually need to explore different traditions, different technologies. Find out what practices resonate for you, depending on your character structure, depending on how your system works. Some will be more effective than others. And so, as in that first reading, there are times in life when you are struggling and you continue, times when you are down and you realize that only you have control of shifting your attention to heaven, whatever that means for you. There are times in practice where we find ourselves coasting, certainly I do, a certain level of comfort where I cease paying attention. Where I sort of stop inquiring deeper. And I'd like to talk tonight about some of the keys to the doing practices, to the willful practices, and some of the qualities of investigation, and some of the practices that lead to surrender. Last year, there was a team of researchers at the University of Washington who were exploring the effect of meditation on multitasking in real-world settings. And they set up a very rigid study where they asked people to do the things that they would normally do in an office. They were given a laptop and a phone. They were asked to schedule meetings for multiple attendees, locate free conference rooms, write memos. All the information had to be done within 20 minutes. And so they took people who had experience in meditation, those who had no experience in meditation, and those who had some experience in sort of learning relaxation techniques. And as you might imagine, those who had training in meditation performed at a much higher level than those that didn't. And what they found was there was enhanced connectivity between the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is involved in attention monitoring and working memory, and the right insula, which is an area that's associated with how well we can monitor our feelings and thoughts. And you've been doing this these days. Concentration, bringing yourself back again and again and again. And can you feel your dorsolateral prefrontal cortex just starting to merge and talk to your right insula? If nothing else, you'll be better at multitasking at the end of this retreat. But there have been over 10,000 studies on the effect of meditation on the brain. And it's fascinating to see the effect of what these technologies do to the brain and to the capacity of how your brain functions. But there's much more than just your capacity to multitask that comes out of willful concentration practice. Karma is basically cause and effect. Every action has a consequence. Every time you disengage from the cognitive function, from thinking, back to the direct experiential happening in the here and now, you're creating a profound shift in your brain, a profound shift in consciousness. And you may have noticed over the last couple days some of the elements which can be somewhat quantified as a result of concentration practice. You might have noticed your capacity to stay with your experience for longer and longer periods of time. There is a quality of calm and ease that begins to manifest through concentration practice. Of course, this takes time and practice. Pat talked about the hindrances, these five weather systems that just pull us off course of aversion, of craving, of anxiety, restlessness, and worry, of sloth and torpor, doubt. Every time you bring yourself back to your anchor, you're creating a profound shift. And in that struggle, there are just little awarenesses that can really make a difference. We tend to think of concentration as a forcing of ourselves. And it can be very different to try a few techniques I'd like to just to sort of share with you here. One teacher likes to use this technique, that when she's distracted by a sound, she might notice there's a sound and the breath. There's an emotion and the breath. So there is an acknowledgement of what's arising and the inclusion of the breath. Very subtle, but that practice of inclusion has a sort of a softening effect. You might also have noticed your capacity to stay present in the midst of what's happening. You know, our experience is very much like a river or a waterfall, this constant cascade of sensations, of thoughts, of moods, of different states. And your capacity to concentrate allows you to stay present to the flow. Pat mentioned something I'd like to reinforce, that I have found as an effective tool for concentration, and that is the concept of aiming and sustaining. You have your anchor, you sort of lodge your attention on the anchor, and that's the question of sort of sustaining your attention there. And there's a sense of trust that over time, your mind will begin to settle into the breath or your anchor, and will begin to let go of extraneous thoughts. And you may have begun to experience that shift over these hours and hours and hours. So the practice of aiming attention. One of the classic analogies for meditation I often use when I'm with beginners, but it's always a really, really helpful, is to remember what it's like to train a puppy. You tell the puppy to sit. The puppy looks at you adoringly, has no idea what you're talking about. You push your little button to the ground, you say, sit. The puppy is off and running. Two ways to train the puppy. One is to stand over it with a rolled up newspaper and whack it if it moves. You're not going to get a very healthy puppy that way. The other is to remember that's the nature of a puppy. That's what puppies do. And with patience and with persistence, the puppy begins to sit for longer and longer periods of time. When we can remember that sort of compassionate, patient, persistence quality for our own minds, is a qualitative shift. It's the difference between chastising ourselves and when we lose the anchor and celebrating when we remember it. It can be helpful to think of the breath as your anchor, as a delicate creature. And when you just sort of feel your breath right now, you can just sort of feel how delicate it is. And just bringing that sort of gentle, attentive care can be a very soft way to come in contact with it. And can you imagine just now, maybe just to close your eyes, the sense of receiving the breath? Rather than trying to find the breath, can you let the breath come to you? And rather than directing your attention to the breath, there's one teacher who uses this little phrase where she says, "May my attention rest with the breath." And you might just sense that qualitative experience when you explore that. May my attention rest with the breath. It has a very gentle quality to it. So just a few words about aiming and sustaining. When you come in and to sit for 45 minutes, somewhere in the back of your mind there may be this thought, I'm going to hold my attention on the breath for the next 45 minutes. That's a challenging thing to do. When we kind of set a high bar, it can be a little depressing. But the sense of sort of aiming and sustaining can be very helpful. To just sort of bring your attention to the breath and just track how long you can sustain your attention on the experience of the breath. After a while, you'll lose the connection with it. And then again, you can just refresh the inquiry. May my attention rest with the breath. And just notice how long you can sustain the breath. You might explore what it's like to connect with just half a breath as a way to sort of make it a little bit easier for the mind to engage, just to feel half a breath. When we can bring this sense of relaxation into our practice, a light touch, there can be at times a very delicate riding of the experience. Of course, you have to meet the mind where it is. There are times when you have just the right amount of sleep, just the right amount of nutrition, no distracting sounds. You may find it very easy to sort of aim the attention toward the anchor and sustain the attention on the anchor. On the other hand, there may be times when there's not enough sleep. Maybe you've overeaten a little bit. Maybe the mind is on some obsessive hamster wheel. Or maybe you're really disturbed by the noises in the room. Then a different form of effort, one that sort of amps up the energy a little bit, might be required. But there are three qualities that can emerge out of your concentration practice. And you can't make these happen. They're kind of an organic byproduct of them. One is described as an experience of rapture. And that is more like a physical feeling of pleasure, a feeling that you're kind of floating in space. I'm just curious, anyone have any moments like that over the last couple of days? Yeah. A physical feeling of pleasure, maybe a sense of floating in space. Another byproduct is an experience of happiness, which is more of a mental pleasure, not so much of like a physical sensation, but sort of a mental sense of deep pleasure in the moment. And you might experience a sense of tranquility or a sense of balance, and that's kind of best described as simply a feeling of no problem. You're just present, there are no problems. And of course, the hindrances come and go. And the willful practice brings us back, collects our energy and our awareness in the here and now. So, the benefit, calming, a centering, relaxing, a little more of a sense of resting and presence, maybe a little more awareness of the space between the thoughts. Maybe you've touched into that sense of physical pleasure, of mental pleasure, a sense of no problem. And willful practices can move you in that direction. Another form of willful practice that you're engaging into in these days is what we could call restraint with awareness. In observing the precepts, you've taken an internal vow to do no harm, to not take what is not yours, to refrain from mood-altering substances, to refrain from speaking, from not reading, from no eye contact. And these are all willful practices, and they tend to help us to build energy. They tend to help you contain your experience. And you may have noticed that in the practice of silence, you may have noticed that the conversations in your head are getting a little bit more enhanced. Someone was sharing in a group where they just said, am I more insane than usual, or is this really what's going on inside? We start to realize that the mind doesn't stop, and that it's pretty shameless. There's nowhere where it won't go. So as you deepen concentration, you cultivate your capacity to be aware of what's happening while it's happening. You ever see the YouTube clips of people who are texting while they're walking? There is one that went viral of a woman who was texting in a mall and walked right into a water fountain. You can say they were very concentrated, but they were not very aware. And concentration is not the be-all, the end-all of the practice. As I like to say, there are a lot of concentrated people on the planet who are miserable. But what concentration does is it sets up your capacity for investigation, to begin to explore not only what's happening while it's happening, but to see an ever-increasing aliveness, your relationship to what's happening, how you're holding your experience. So the word vipassana means to see clearly. We're practicing seeing clearly meditation. Having your anchor is a way of bringing you back again and again to what's actually happening, moving from the cognitive to the experience. And again you move from thought and commentary to the immediate experience of what's here and now. So I got to practice this investigation, particularly the night before last. As I mentioned, at 10:30 I woke up soaked in sweat. I had a fever, I tried to ignore it. 10:40 I realized I had some pretty severe nausea. Again, I thought I'd ignore it. 10:41 I realized I couldn't ignore the nausea, and I hightailed it to the bathroom. Around 11, I realized this was going to be here for a while. Around 2, I realized the nausea was coming at about 20-minute intervals. And around 7, I realized maybe I wasn't going to be leading the yoga. So we talk about RAIN, this acronym for investigation, for mindful investigation, to recognize or realize what's presenting, to explore if you can allow or accept what's here, to investigate with kindness, to be intimate with your experience, and ultimately to lead to a sense of non-identification or a sense of natural awareness. So I couldn't help but recognize something was going on. And I couldn't help but allow it because it was so, shall we say, dominant in my experience. So that left me with the I, the investigation piece. I had quite a few hours to be with this. So I thought I'd share with you some of the strategies that I used. Some of them were pretty effective. Some of them were not so skillful. In the midst of physical pain, emotional turmoil, mental turmoil, it's helpful to remember the teaching of the second arrow, that our experience is painful, but whenever we add to it any form of resistance, we're actually increasing the suffering. So one thing I tried to do was to notice that when my mind would start to catastrophize of how terrible this was. The next day I had a group interview, I had some private interviews, I had the yoga classes to lead and a talk at the end of the day, so I was pretty mentally agitated. I found myself kind of obsessing, and then I remembered the teaching of the second arrow. So I tried as best as I could to bring myself to what was happening without adding anything to it. There's a phrase from the Satipatthana Sutta that has been very helpful for me for working with difficult sensations. It goes like this. The monk remains focused on the body in and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. So to train yourself to be with what is actually happening, putting aside greed and distress for the world. When I could do that, all I was left with was pure sensation. And that would sustain for a little while. And then, of course, the mind would come in with another story. I explored my beliefs in a way kind of to reframe my experience, because the belief was, this is terrible. So I asked myself, what's good about this? I entertained that one for a while. I remembered a phrase my father once shared with me in the midst of some suffering where he said, you know, no one's shooting at you. So that was helpful. You I've realized that I'm surrounded by caring people. I thought maybe this is a deep purification. I'm going to feel really, really clear when all this stuff is moved through. So looking at my beliefs helped me to sort of shift my experience a little bit. When I had some energy, I explored really diving in to where the sensations were the most unpleasant. And this is can be a very interesting technique of really going in, zooming in to the sensations to see if I could identify the unpleasant, the neutral, and the pleasant sensations. And sometimes when you can do this in your investigation, you begin to see that what looks solid is actually a very alive and moving around. So I tried that for a while. There were times when it felt like it was too much. So I sort of shifted gears to another technique that's oftentimes used when working with trauma. And that is to find somewhere in my body where my body wasn't freaking out. And for me, that was the soles of my feet. The soles of my feet felt fine. The rest of me was completely freaked out. But this is a very interesting kind of attentional strategy because it actually allowed me to stay present. Then I could sort of move from where I didn't feel it to just sort of swing into where I felt it until it felt like it was too much. And that actually gave me a deep sense of encouragement that I actually had the capacity to stay with it, not to disassociate, but to stay with it when it was at its worst. At one point, I had a really, really bad headache, and so I tried just scanning through that area. And actually, so I was sort of imagining as my awareness was sort of moving through it, I was sort of like combing through it. And there was this sort of, that was a very interesting technique for a little while. It felt like there was sort of like I was aware of where I was clenched, and it would just calm a little bit, and I could feel a little bit of subtle energy flowing through. At times, I explored bringing some kindness and some compassion to the places that where it really, really hurt, where the really deep ouch was. And I could feel a little bit of a shift. Because I had a lot of time on my hands, I also explored bringing my attention into where the sensation was the most predominant and trying to imagine or feel the space inside of that. And that had an effect of sort of bringing a little more, just a little more space, a little more feeling, a little more ease into it. But none of these really made a huge shift. I was riding some pretty intense waves. And I think it was in the midst of my misery, and this is where the line from the poem came. But no one can keep you from lifting your heart toward heaven, only you. It is in the middle of misery that so much becomes clear. The one who says nothing good came out of this is not yet listening. This was just the spontaneous cognition. And I just thought, other people feel this too. Because I'd heard there were other people who were sick, not feeling well. And my awareness just moved to them, and I realized, I'm not alone. And so I decided to sort of move into that, and I moved into the Tonglen practice, just with my breath. As I inhale, just to think of all the other people who feel this, and to exhale, and just to offer a sense of peace, a sense of compassion. And I could instantly feel that moving from those in this retreat, my awareness sort of spread out to everyone who's in pain, everyone who's suffering. And for a while, it felt unbearable. There was a real deep tremor, you know, all through my body and my heart, just to really feel and appreciate all those who are suffering. But over time, I began to feel a shift. And the shift was moving from a very kind of self-centered, self-protective state to a state that felt more expansive. It felt more open. a sense of that tightly held I and mine, it began to dissolve, it began to shift. It was quite profound. Later, as I was on my adventure, I explored just letting go, just surrendering to it. And that was quite a ride unto itself. There's a story from the Tibetan tradition of a powerful woman meditator and healer and mendicant who was pursued by some powerful demons, powerful energies. They were offended at how peaceful she was, how much equanimity she had, and they were determined to harass her and intimidate her and pull her out of that state. And these were really powerful demons. Everyone was intimidated and frightened by these energies. And so they gave her everything she had. And as the story goes, she transformed her body into a food offering for the demons and invited them to feed freely. And because there was no ego in the offering, the demons had nothing to feed on. But the gesture, that egoless gesture of offering up, the demons recognized the incredible presence and power, and they offered themselves as allies for her. And so after all these doing practices, I decided just to let go. I stopped fighting, I stopped trying to manage it, I stopped trying to fix it. And what happened? Sometimes it felt better, sometimes it felt worse. For periods it stayed the same. But what did shift was again that sense of I and my. I wasn't trying to manage it. It was just happening by itself. The third Zen patriarch said, "Make the slightest distinction between good and bad, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to know the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you don't like is a disease of the mind." All the practices I did over those hours helped me in different ways. Willfully staying with my horrible, no good experience strengthened my capacity to endure. It brought me closer to what was actually happening. Not my story, but what was actually happening. Recognizing that I was not alone opened my heart, expanded my awareness. And surrendering to my experience, it softened and opened the field from a tightly held experience to one that was more spacious and more alive. So I thought it might be interesting to do a little reflection, to maybe try on some of these strategies in little forms. If you like, you can close your eyes. You might like to bring into mind a difficulty you've experienced, perhaps during this retreat, something that's sort of arisen in your experience, a challenging moment, a challenging emotion, a challenging memory. And I thought we might explore a few strategies just to experience how it might shift or change your experience on the inside. I'll offer you a few suggestions, and then I'll give you some time to practice, just to observe what shifts or changes or moves. So you might, in your own way, bring into mind something you might like to investigate. The more specific you can make this investigation, the better. You might take a moment to just recall it. If there are any visuals or any words or sounds you associate with this. And you might begin to really sense what it feels like on the inside as you reflect on your experience, as you shift from the story to the experience. How does your life force resonate with this issue? How intimately can you locate what it feels like on the inside? You might explore zooming in and locating precisely the play of unpleasant, pleasant, and neutral sensations. And as you observe, notice how it changes. What happens if you bring a sense of kindness or empathy or compassion to this felt sense inside? How does it shift or move or change? You might explore over the next minute, reflecting on that other people feel this too. As you breathe in, to acknowledge all those who share this experience, and as you breathe out, to offer a sense of calming or peace or compassion. And as you breathe, track what might move or shift or change on the inside. Whatever your internal experience may be, however it may have shifted, you might explore letting it be. If you were to let go of managing it or controlling it, but to simply give it permission, if that feels safe, how does it move or shift or change? And as you sense what is present inside, you might ask it the following question. How would you like me to be with you right now? Acknowledging what may have shifted or changed or moved, you might deepen your breath. If you like, you can open the eyes, or if you like, you can remain with them closed. This art of investigation is exploring all the ways that you can be with your experience. When you can, from a centered place inside, actively investigate what is here, you'll notice many different things. you'll notice the reality of what it's like on the inside. Not your story, not your preferences, not your embellishment, but what's actually there. In the midst of all turmoil, the antidote seems to be a quality of non-judging presence, of your capacity of calling on compassion, kindness, of empathy, remembering that other people feel this too can have a powerful way of opening the field from one that's tight to one that opens to new possibilities. So concentration and willful practices will help you to stay present when the going gets rough. It'll help you to pierce through your story to contact what's actually happening. And then where does surrender come in? There's a great kind of classic story of a martial arts student who goes to a teacher and says, I really want to study your system. How long will it take for me to master it? The teacher looked at him and says, about 10 years. And the guy says, well, what if I doubled up on everything? You know, what if I worked twice as hard? What if I put in more hours? How long would it take then? The teacher said, about 20 years. So back to the story of the teacher who gave contradictory advice, telling some people to focus more, telling other people to relax more, to lighten up. That middle way, not too tight, not too loose, is constantly moving. And your inner wisdom is your highest teacher. It's your intuition to get stronger and stronger the more you practice. And I love, personally, I love that question of how does this moment want me to be with it right now? It's a very powerful question that can heighten your sense of intuition. When we contract, we're in fear. And I certainly noticed that over the last couple of days, a sense of self-absorption, kind of a putting up a shell of self-protection. And as the saying goes, when you're in fear, you believe that you're a separate wave on the ocean, that you're one wave cut off from all the other waves. And when you're awake, you remember that you are the entire ocean. So how do we shift our attention to remembering that we are the ocean? There are a number of strategies, you know, some that I've mentioned. Remembering that other people feel this too can soften or melt or kind of disperse the sense of I and mine. And there's another approach which may or may not resonate for you. It can be interesting from time to time to reflect your attention back on awareness itself. It's very challenging. If you think of yourself as an eyeball, how does the eyeball become aware of itself when it's what you're looking through? When we look at awareness itself, words fall apart pretty quickly. I oftentimes think of like the best poems and the best sutras, or they're like balloons. They're words that sort of describe the space inside the balloon. And we can't really grasp it with the linear rational mind. So I kind of see this as a three-step process. The first is to notice what's present in the moment, a thought, an emotion, a sensation. And your capacity to notice and to pay attention is most probably greatly enhanced over these last few days. You're more aware of the stream, kind of the waterfall of cascading sensations, thoughts, states, moods, thought forms. The second part of the practice is to direct your attention back to the subject, to ask, what is thinking? What is feeling? The third step of the practice is simply to relax and surrender into the inquiry. There are a few things I think that are helpful. One is that you're not looking for a linear rational answer. It's more like you're directing your attention to an experience when you ask yourself, what is it that's listening right now? It's sort of a moment, a pause there. And again, we're back to the sense of aim and sustain. So I'd like to do just a little experience. We're going to try this with a bell. And we'll just try this on. When you hear the strike of the bell, to notice it, and then to ask, what is listening? And simply surrender into the question. As you continue in your practice, as you feel your practice deepening, this kind of inquiry can be helpful sometimes. This is challenging to do when you are fighting the hindrances, when all these different weather systems are making it hard to be present. You don't want to get grim about this inquiry. I've spent many retreats trying to force this practice, and it's precisely the opposite of how it works. The surrender practices can be quite powerful. It's a practice of non-manipulation, a practice of just letting your experience be. Choiceless awareness is your capacity to be with what is. And when you explore what it means to surrender, there are some near enemies to be aware of. They look like surrender, but they're not really surrender. One is sort of like a premature surrender to avoid pain. One of my favorite Monty Python movies, The Holy Grail. One scene, they're running toward the castle gates, yelling, "Attack! Attack!" The next scene, they're going, "Run away! Run away!" Have you ever had that experience of just turning tail? It's sort of premature surrender. The second one is resignation. That what can look like surrender is actually more of a giving up, some form of a sense of self-betrayal, of not speaking up, not acting. So it can be easy to get confused about how to be in the present moment. But ultimately, it's your inner wisdom that is your guide. When you can ask, how does this moment want me to be with it right now? You may get a sense of what's called for. It might be to tighten your attention, to narrow your attention, to kind of gather the scattered mind and bring it into one place and actively cultivate a sense of calm, a sense of presence, to kind of gain access to that sense of deep calm. The physical peace, the mental peace, the sense of tranquility. It might be to hold your anchor very gently, to kind of allow you to feel more of a sense of the flow, to sort of experience the stream of thoughts and feelings and sensations. There may be times when it feels most natural to simply explore choiceless awareness, just to inquire into what it is that's feeling. What is it that's sensing and thinking and perceiving? Your capacity can be narrowed down like a light through a magnifying glass with a capacity to burn wood. And you can also open your awareness as vast as the sky. Your capacity to be with anything and everything that comes into form and falls out of form. And just as light is malleable, so is your awareness. the willful practices, the surrender practices, they each have their place and they are intimately connected. And as confusing as all of this can be at times, I truly feel that the highest quality in any given moment is your sincerity. And when you can call upon your deepest sincerity, you can always trust that that will be your highest guide in any moment. So why don't we close with a short meditation and a short reading. You might just for a few moments draw your attention into the breath. May my awareness rest with the breath. Can you feel how delicate the breath is? The sense of, rather than finding the breath, receiving the breath. And can you sense all the benefits of this sense of relaxed concentration, the fruit of calm, of centering? And in these remaining moments, can you sense the quality of allowing, of non-manipulation? I'll close with these words from Ajahn Chah. Do not try to become anything. Do not make yourself into anything. Do not be a meditator. Do not become enlightened. When you sit, let it be. When you walk, let it be. Grasp at nothing. Resist nothing. Namaste. Thank you for your kind presence and your attention. It feels good to be back. Mm-hmm.